The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hello, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the New Yorker magazine. We just witnessed a historic wildcat strike led by the Milwaukee Bucks to protest police brutality in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and beyond. The team took action in the wake of even more rapid activism by the WNBA. This week, I will read a selection of pieces from the New Yorker archives about athletes and political activism. I'll begin with an article from the sporting scene of the online New Yorker magazine, August 27, 2020. The Exhilarating Jolt of the Milwaukee Bucks Wildcat Strike by Vincent Cunningham. On Tuesday evening, the Milwaukee Bucks star forward Giannis Antetokounmpo was named the NBA's Defensive Player of the Year. Antetokounmpo is 6 feet 11 and looks like an elongated version of Michelangelo's David. He won the league's Most Valuable Player award last year and is considered a favorite to win it again. When he's not spiking home yet another of his assaultive dunks, he's leaping gracefully to pin somebody's shot to the backboard and start a fast break, or stepping up and unfurling his eagle's wingspan to check a point guard on the perimeter. His latest accolade was something to celebrate, a sign that the NBA had got back to its normal business of showcasing the rare marvels of its players. But the scene at the press conference organized in Antetokounmpo's honor was something less than ecstatic. He smiled shyly as his teammate Brook Lopez handed him the trophy and batted back tears as he thanked his fellow Bucks. Behind him, his teammates wore dark shirts. One of the shirts bore a slogan, "Silence is violence." Another bore the names of recently slain black people. Trayvon Martin, in squiggly print, floated just above Antetokounmpo's left shoulder. On another one was a drawing of George Floyd's smiling face. 2 days earlier, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, just 40 miles from Milwaukee, where the Bucks usually play their home games, a black man named Jacob Blake had been shot 7 times in the back, in full view of his children, by a police officer. Rumors were spreading that players on various teams might not want to keep playing. Toward the end of the ceremony, the broadcaster Ernie Johnson asked the Bucks head coach, Mike Budenholzer, whether any such plans were being discussed among his players. "Well, we've had good conversation," Budenholzer said, "and I think, you know, to keep that within our family, within our group, I think at this point is the wisest thing." On Wednesday evening, the Bucks were set to play Game 5 of their first-round playoff series against the Orlando Magic. They were expected to win, finishing off the series, and to turn their attention to their next, more formidable opponent. But as the time for tip-off approached, something strange happened, or more precisely, didn't happen. The Bucks were nowhere to be seen. The Magic were on the court in their warm-up gear, shooting jumpers and layups, and then summoned by some signal to which we television viewers weren't privy, they all cleared out to. The result was undoubtedly the most memorable image from an already bizarre NBA season, a totally empty court. The Bucks, led, it was later reported, by the veteran guard George Hill, had decided to strike. Bright lights gleamed on the court, uninterrupted by bodies. The seats on the benches, duly distanced because of COVID-19, were empty. The only available words, besides the shocked and slightly panicked vamping of the broadcast team, were the name of the team that had so swiftly disrupted the meeting. The evening, Milwaukee Bucks, scrawled hugely on a digital screen, and Black Lives Matter in big block letters straddling the half-court line. Soon, staff members appeared and started to roll racks of balls and piles of towels away from the court. Party done, they seemed to say. Before long, others were following the Bucks' lead. The whole slate of games for the night, the Houston Rockets against the Oklahoma City Thunder, the Los Angeles Lakers against the Portland Trailblazers, was called off. The WNBA, whose players have again and again shown a readiness to involve themselves in the issues of the day, canceled its Wednesday night games. In Major League Baseball, which nobody thinks of as a hotbed for activism, the Milwaukee Brewers decided not to play their evening game, and other teams subsequently joined them in sitting out. Major League Soccer, which had been the first American men's sport league to make its return, also stood down. Kenny Smith, the retired point guard and celebrated broadcaster, walked off the set of Inside the NBA on TNT in solidarity with the players. The retired player turned color commentator Chris Webber gave an emotional address on the air. "I'm very proud of the players," he said. "I don't know the next steps. I don't really care what the next steps are, because the first steps are to garner attention. And they have everybody's attention." Whatever normalcy sports had achieved would, for a night, be put on pause. To love sports is, on some level, to be a partisan of everyday life. To follow a routine like the one that has been a small but constant joy of my adulthood. Get home, change clothes, open a beer, plop down, turn on the game. Is to assert, consciously or not, that comfort in itself is a virtue. How else could we justify so many hours spent chasing diversion? There's something undoubtedly true and good in this. Real leisure can serve as a final bulwark against a culture that would otherwise keep us focused steadfastly on work, acquisition, and looking at our phones. The games are, of course, commercialized. Viewers absorb advertisements, goose network ratings. Still, it's possible to see the kind of placid off time it takes to watch sports as a noble goal of politics. The upshot of the signal gains of the 19th and 20th century labor movement, the 8-hour workday and the 5-day workweek, is that free time tends toward freedom. But the dark side of leisure is mollifying entertainment. The message often slips from comfort is good into everything is fine. Before the NBA season resumed in July, several players, most prominently the Brooklyn Nets point guard Kyrie Irving, shared their reservations about coming back at all. A virus, unabated by an all but indifferent government, was killing thousands of people, disproportionately poor and non-white. And protests against police killings were filling the streets. Why help the most comfortable Americans lull themselves more ardently to sleep? Why act like life was normal when it wasn't? The argument that won the day, however, was that the league's bubble in Orlando would serve as a platform for social justice. Players would tote the catchphrases of pet causes on their jerseys. Black Lives Matter, peace, education reform, and the more esoteric group economics were among the slogans agreed upon by the NBA, the Players' Union, and the league's jersey sponsor, Nike. Black Lives Matter would adorn each court. In pregame interviews and postgame press conferences, players would have the chance to talk about politics instead of the customary business of recalling plays and sharing platitudes about teamwork. That plan bore out. LeBron James used much of his time with the media to call for the arrest of the police officers who killed Breonna Taylor. The players had their stage, and they used it well. But just as the economic cataclysm and the stay-at-home orders that accompanied the coronavirus helped spark the George Floyd protests in Minneapolis and elsewhere, the experience of being cooped up in the NBA's bubble, and therefore rendered impotent when the news of the Blake shooting started to spread, seemed to be a radicalizing force among the players. They seemed impatient with symbolism and pat messages. "I want to go protest," the Boston Celtics forward Jaylen Brown tweeted. Some observers questioned the efficacy and ultimate direction of a strike and contrasted it with the players' use of their bubble-born platform. But the strike itself was an instant agent of clarity. That it started with a team like the Bucks, one of whose players has filed a federal civil rights suit against the city of Milwaukee and its police over their treatment of him after an apparent parking violation, highlighted how widespread and persistent the problem of police violence is. That it threatened the profits of NBA team owners, a few of whom are notable supporters of Donald Trump, underlined the fact that the trajectory of oppression in America is not only racial, but economic. That racial differentiation and capitalistic exploitation are fatally synchronized. Thursday afternoon, according to several reports, the players voted to end the strike and resume the seasons. Shams Charania, a writer for The Athletic, noted in a tweet that those who voted to play again, James reportedly among them, had invoked the sense of normalcy returning, with the players' families soon coming to the bubble. The spectacle of the empty court on Wednesday night, a stage for action rendered radiantly fallow, had been a rejection of normalcy, however brief. During Antetokounmpo's Defensive Player of the Year ceremony, Kenny Smith had asked him to recall his difficult youth. Antetokounmpo was born in Athens, Greece, to immigrants from Lagos, Nigeria. He spent the early part of his life without citizenship in either place, constantly afraid of being detained by immigration officials. He sold watches and handbags on the street to help his family get by. "All I know," Antetokounmpo told Smith, "is hard work." Many other NBA players have similarly tough stories and similar outlooks on the salvific power of industry. But on Wednesday, they seemed to recognize that the most powerful thing they could do was not to work, and that the most astounding use of their platform was to step off of it. The best use of the normalcy that their great gifts helped the rest of us enjoy was, for a moment, to take it away. And now, from the March 22, 2017 edition of the New Yorker magazine, the cultural comment section, "The Political Athlete, Then and Now," by Hua Su. On Monday evening, just hours after Congress had convened hearings investigating whether Russia had interfered with last November's election, President Donald Trump was back in his comfort zone, on the road, flexing his unpredictable kitchen sink approach to working a crowd, rallying his supporters against a bizarre, albeit easy, target. In this case, Colin Kaepernick, the former San Francisco 49ers quarterback. Last season, Kaepernick transcended his station as a backup on a bad team when he began kneeling during the national anthem, his way of drawing attention to issues of police brutality and inequality. Trump never named Kaepernick, instead referring to him as "your San Francisco quarterback. I'm sure nobody ever heard of him." He referred to an article about how, quote, NFL owners don't want to pick him up because they don't want to get a nasty tweet from Donald Trump. You believe that? It's unclear whether Kaepernick realized any of this as it was happening. He has been preoccupied with an online organizing effort to get clean water to drought-affected Somalia. As if, by reply, Kaepernick donated $50,000 to Meals on Wheels on Tuesday. that Kaepernick seemed an unlikely activist gave last season's protest a particular gravity. He was a quirky player known for his daring, occasionally reckless approach to playing quarterback. But up until that point, he was more likely to draw attention for his touchdown celebrations, a bicep kiss, or for wearing an opposing team's cap, it matched his outfit, than for his politics. At first, nobody noticed that he was kneeling in protest at all, given the teeming chaos of NFL sidelines. But once pressed, he spoke with the clear-eyed conviction of someone who had discovered a new purpose. He donated significant chunks of his salary to progressive causes, and he began working with the activist Sean King and the sociologist Harry Edwards on building institutions that might outlast his playing career. Last fall, a local artist painted a mural of Kaepernick in Oakland, hostile territory for the 49ers. "We got your back," it read. Teammates, other NFL players and athletes in other sports, from the standout American soccer player Megan Rapinoe to countless high school students, joined him in kneeling. Kaepernick recently announced that he was encouraged by the conversations that his protest had inspired. Perhaps eager to show prospective employers that he would no longer be a distraction, he pledged that he would be standing again. Whether a player who seems admired by his peers but hated by upper management ever performs again in the NFL remains to be seen, especially given the president's perpetual eagerness to show off his Twitter muscles. Kaepernick was hardly the first, and he surely won't be the last, to violate many fans' wishes that athletes stick to sports. But his situation, from his desire to speak his mind to the air of presidentially approved collusion that surrounds his free agency, is a reminder of how the positions of athletes and celebrities have changed in the social media era. In January, Haymarket Books published Long Shot, the autobiography of the former NBA player and freedom fighter Craig Hodges. Hodges was one of the finest three-point shooters of his era, playing in the NBA for 10 years and winning two titles with the Chicago Bulls. He was one of the most politically outspoken players the league's ever seen, a locker room agitator, proselytizing to teammates and staff on behalf of grassroots political movements. And, at a time when off-court grievances were rarely aired in public, Hodges was unrelenting in his criticisms of millionaire athletes who didn't give back to their communities. "How much money did we make here last night?" he wondered aloud to a reporter during the 1992 NBA Finals. "How many lives will it change?" He went on to accuse his teammate Michael Jordan of bailing out when the superstar was asked his thoughts on the recent Los Angeles riots. Hodges' beliefs became very public when the Bulls visited the White House after winning the 1992 championship. Hodges wore a dashiki and delivered a handwritten letter to President George H.W. Bush about racial and economic inequality. Though he was a key member of two championship teams, as well as the reigning three-time champion of the All-Star Weekend three-point contest, the 32-year-old Hodges was released by the Bulls. He would never play in the NBA again. Long Shot tracks Hodges' political awakening from black studies courses in college to his early run-ins with Donald Sterling, the notoriously racist owner of the San Diego and later Los Angeles Clippers. The trajectory is clear, and despite the occasionally engrossing glimpse into the typical NBA player's home life, Hodges' tumult involved R. Kelly. Almost every detail is shared as context for his more radical turn in the late 80s and 90s. Hodges becomes active in the players' union. He begins organizing in the locker room, encouraging teammates to speak out against sweatshop labor or the exploitation of black communities. In 1991, Hodges even tried convincing Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson to lead a boycott of All-Star Weekend. everyone in the league knew they were eventually going to get an earful of political talk if they bumped into me, he writes. No surprise, the most memorable moments of Longshot involve Hodges calling others out. None of the Bulls stars, Jordan, Horace Grant, Scottie Pippen, knew black history. Here were some of the most influential black men in America, and they were blind to the impact U.S. foreign policy had around the world, Hodges said. In one astounding scene, the Bulls coach Phil Jackson backs up Hodges, chiding Jordan and the others' ignorance about the Gulf War, offering a prophetic vision of the coming decades. Eventually, Hodges begins to fear that Jordan and his powerful agent, David Falk, are conspiring to run him out of the league. Whether Hodges was blacklisted or not remains a mystery, but his situation was always going to be precarious. It's certainly likely that teams weighed his fiery outspokenness against a potentially diminishing skill set. He sued the league for damages, but the case was dismissed on a technicality. Hodges would play overseas for a year before returning to the league as a coach. He is currently the head basketball coach at his high school alma mater, Rich East, just outside of Chicago. For a while, Hodges' life seemed a cautionary tale. Yet today, it is the league's biggest names who are front and center in political debates, from players like LeBron James and Carmelo Anthony speaking about Black Lives Matter to coaches like Stan Van Gundy, Greg Popovich, and Steve Kerr, sharing their anxieties about the current political leadership. The league office pulled All-Star Weekend from North Carolina after the state eliminated anti-discrimination protections for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Sports makes for an imperfect reflection of society, in part because its stakes are both crystal clear, there are winners and losers, yet mercifully low, there is always next year. And so the moral drama of sports falls on our ability to interpret and project. It's the stories we tell ourselves about achievement and meritocracy, the integrity of hallowed statistical feats, even the puritanical attitude toward performance-enhancing drugs. It's the stubborn belief that a hard luck franchise or a dignified veteran deserves a trophy more than his competitor, or LeBron James tempering the ecstasy of a fought-for championship by remembering where he had come from. I'm just a kid from Akron, he said last summer after his Cavaliers defeated the Warriors in the NBA Finals, reflecting on how the odds are aligned against young black men like him. Athletes have always been political, but until recently they rarely possessed the means to explain themselves so directly to their fans. Where Hodges' generation worked hard to ingratiate themselves with the American mainstream, today's athletes possess a relative freedom when it comes to speaking their minds, taking risky political stands, or acting with a kind of blunt directness. It's what makes today's players seem so different. Their capacity to share more in a late-night Instagram post than a decade of carefully stage-managed, Nike-approved Jordan documentaries. Maybe the difference between then and now is just an instinctive awareness that everything is political. The game resists our desire for it to be an escape from the rest of life, where the rules can seem arbitrary and unpredictable, and there can be one winner to every 99 who have lost. And now, from the December 17, 2018 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the Sporting Scene section, Michael Bennett's Political Football. The Philadelphia Eagles defensive end wants NFL players to be a force for social change. By Louisa Thomas. When the Star Spangled Banner was played before the first game of the 2018 NFL season between the Atlanta Falcons and the Philadelphia Eagles, the defending champions in September, Michael Bennett knew that he was being watched. Football fans and sports writers were waiting to see if the narrative of another year would be dominated not by division rivalries, but by the debate over players who protested racial inequality during the national anthem. Colin Kaepernick, the San Francisco's 49ers quarterback who had begun the protests in 2016, was the star of a new Nike commercial that was set to air during the game. The tagline, "Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything." But Kaepernick had been out of the league since the end of that season. He has sued the owners, alleging collusion, and Nike campaign aside, rarely spoke publicly. Bennett, a defensive end for the Eagles, was one of the most recognizable players to keep the protests going in his absence. A three-time Pro Bowler, Bennett is naturally funny and a little eccentric, with a gift for provocation. He used to do a little jig, inspired by pro wrestling, each time he sacked a quarterback. He once described it as two angels dancing while chocolate is coming from the heavens on a nice Sunday morning. His equally gregarious younger brother, Martellus, was a tight end until he retired earlier this year, and they were an unmistakable pair, the outrageous, outspoken Bennett brothers. Bennett has always been candid about politics. In 2015, after his teammate Richard Sherman critiqued the rhetoric of the Black Lives Matter movement, Bennett, unprompted, politely detailed his disagreements with Sherman at a press conference the next day. He wrote a statement expressing solidarity with the women's strike on International Women's Day. He is an avid reader of the academic and activist Angela Davis. But in the year since he began protesting, in August 2017, the political has become increasingly personal, and he has been reminded what it can mean to be a black man in the wrong place at the wrong time. That month, he was handcuffed in Las Vegas by police officers with weapons drawn during what the officers believed was an active shooter situation, an instance Bennett maintains of racial profiling. A few weeks later, a doctored photograph that had Bennett dancing in the Seahawks locker room with a burning American flag went viral. In March, he was indicted on a felony charge for allegedly pushing an elderly woman as he made his way onto the field after the 2017 Super Bowl, an accusation that he emphatically denies. In April, he published a memoir called Things That Make White People Uncomfortable, which was blurbed by Bernie Sanders, among others. These days, Bennett sits at the nexus of several narratives surrounding the NFL. What a fan thinks of him probably depends on which of those narratives the fan is inclined to credit. On opening night, Bennett knew that many people wanted to move on from the protest. He was tired himself of the endless accounting of who was taking a knee and who wasn't, and eager to focus on the social justice work that he and others were doing, rather than on gestures that they were or weren't making. But he also thought that silence had a corrosive effect, that it encouraged pride and toughness above empathy and vulnerability, contributing to the problem of toxic masculinity, as he put it to me before the season began. Using a phrase that has come into vogue in some places, but not, for the most part, in NFL locker rooms. Bennett, who has a lively, wide-set set of eyes and an unruly beard, can rapidly shift in conversation from careful deliberation to surprising bluntness, or to comedy. He answered one of my phone calls with a falsetto squeal, "Don't you call my husband!" The expectation that players should be merely entertainers was stunting, he said. Then we wonder why guys commit suicide or guys do different things, because they just don't know how to find a better way to outlet their emotions. He went on, they don't know how to communicate. How could he communicate that? How could he do it while playing a game where the point was to dominate violently the other side? How could he do it with the platform he had in the space of a song? Bennett had been traded to the Eagles by the Seattle Seahawks in the offseason, and he was still trying with occasional awkwardness to figure out his role with Philadelphia. But he felt lucky in his new teammates. One of them, the safety Malcolm Jenkins, is a co-founder of the Players Coalition, which was created in 2017 in order to harness burgeoning activism among NFL players. When the anthem was performed during the previous season, Jenkins had raised his fist while a white teammate, the defensive end Chris Long, put his arm around Jenkins' shoulder. Jenkins had stopped doing this late last year after the NFL committed $89 million toward racial justice causes. But Jenkins had protested again before the first preseason game, alongside Long and the defensive back Devontae Bosby, after the league attempted to implement a rule that would have required players who were on the field for the anthem to stand. Assuming that Jenkins would raise his fist, Bennett decided that he would stand behind Jenkins and Long and raise his fist too. The gesture would signal solidarity both with his new team and with the movement. He hadn't told them about it, though. When the anthem began to play, he looked over and saw that Jenkins was standing with his hands behind his back and that Long had a hand on his heart. Jenkins had not resumed his protest. It hadn't been an easy decision. "We don't have a handbook," Jenkins told me. Bennett was thrown. I was like, "Wait," he told me later. "Y'all not doing anything?" No one from either team was protesting. Bennett, realizing this, lowered his head, tugged awkwardly on the straps of his gloves. He turned away from the field and began to pace. The grass was still wet from a storm that had just blown through. As the anthem neared its final crescendo, Bennett stopped, sat down on the end of the Eagles bench, and tied his shoe. The season had begun. Bennett is not insensitive to the effects, physical, emotional, psychological, social, of being a professional athlete, particularly one who plays a violent game and plays it violently. He doesn't shy away from the NFL's high-profile cases of violence against women, which have recently been in the news yet again. He has come to see himself as a feminist. It's important to say we want black freedom, but we can't say we want these different things if we don't respect women, he told me. He and his brother have both spoken about how difficult it can be for athletes who are obsessed with beating their opponents to have empathy for others. He sees older players who have struggled not only with the effects of injuries, but also with a crisis of identity once their playing days are over, and an inability to move on from the mental state of being an athlete, as he puts it. Still, Bennett pushes back against the idea that football is by nature in conflict with his commitment to peace. "It's just a game," he told me. He also said that a lot of players have a lot of anger and that they aren't good at being vulnerable, something made worse, he believes, by the habit of talking about players as a bundle of statistics and salary figures and fantasy football point totals. "The business of the NFL or any other business, it doesn't have a soul," he said. Bennett himself has a temper. He can be snappish with other players and with the press. He once yelled at a reporter who questioned him after a loss, claiming that the reporter didn't know what it was like to face adversity. He later apologized privately when he learned that the reporter had survived cancer. But he is, he says, growing. A few years ago, he reconnected with his birth mother, Karanda. When he recounted the story to Dave Zirin, a columnist for The Nation and the co-author of Bennett's memoir, he began to sob. Zirin said, "I never stopped thinking about my kids, and I never stopped loving them." Karanda said recently, "And I wish circumstances had been different. I was young." Bennett told me, "You got to know how to love your mother so that you can love your daughters and your wife properly," he added. "We all have past traumas." 2 weeks after Bennett was traded, he learned that he had been indicted in Houston for injuring an elderly paraplegic woman while trying to get onto the field after the 2017 Super Bowl to celebrate with Martellus, who played for the victorious Patriots. In Texas, recklessly causing bodily injury is a misdemeanor, but it is a felony when the victim is 65 or older. The woman, who is African-American, alleges that Bennett pushed past her as he forced his way through a door onto the field, injuring her shoulder. In announcing the indictment, at a press conference, the Houston police chief, perhaps picking up where the Las Vegas police union left off, spoke about Bennett as if he'd already been convicted, calling him morally corrupt, morally bankrupt, and pathetic. Bennett and the members of his family who were with him fiercely dispute the allegation. "If I saw my son touch an old lady, I would be the one going to court," Michael Sr. told me. Bennett's next court date in the case, which has not yet gone to trial, has been delayed several times. It's currently scheduled for January. In the meantime, Bennett, after beginning the season in a limited role, became a starter again and went on a tear, recording 6.5 sacks in just 6 weeks. The team has lost multiple players to injury, and he spent the season on the fringes of the playoff race. But Bennett, at the age of 33, still relishes the game and his place in it. He has, by all accounts, become more vocal in the locker room as the season has progressed. He has also become close to both Jenkins and Long, who have introduced him to people involved in social justice work in Philadelphia. Bennett brings up ideas that have been a little outside of our scope, Jenkins told me. He'll bring up women's rights. He's big on sustainable food, inner-city gardens, food deserts, things like that. When I asked Bennett during the summer about the split between the Players' Coalition, which he never joined, and those of, like, Eric Reed, who had left it, he said, "Everybody wants the same thing." It was a diplomatic answer, but not an entirely accurate one. Shortly after I visited the locker room in October, the Eagles played the Carolina Panthers, who had just signed Reed. Before the coin toss, Reed confronted Jenkins and had to be restrained. Afterwards, he called Jenkins a sellout and a neo-colonialist, adding, "I think it was James Baldwin that said, to be black in America and to be relatively conscious is to be in a constant state of anger. I'm in a constant state of anger." The fatigue that Bennett sensed before opening night has gone general. Kneeling is no longer the litmus test that it was. Trump hasn't talked about the NFL in months. For a few games, Bennett remained inside the locker room during the anthem. At a game in October, he sat on the bench again. But he has since gone back to staying in the locker room. The protests may never have been as big a deal to fans as they made out to be. U.S. Today broke down the league's ratings decline by market and concluded that the protests were not to blame. Last year, 37 of the 50 most watched TV broadcasts were NFL games. Ratings are up in 2018. Fans are excited about a crop of young quarterbacks. It's possible to look at the league and wonder if the protests really disrupted the status quo at all. But Bennett will tell you that kneeling or not kneeling was by itself never the point, and that something has genuinely shifted. Just before Thanksgiving, the Eagles announced the creation of a social justice fund with money donated by the team and by individual players. Bennett is one of six Eagles serving on its leadership council. They have disbursed about $200,000 so far to four Philadelphia nonprofits. The money will help, Bennett said, but players have to raise awareness of the underlying issues, and they have to show up, he said. They have to get personally involved. The NFL is a small part of the world, he told me before the season started. You know, we like to think that it's the major part of the world, he added, laughing. He says that he can't wait for his daughters to grow up because they can skip the business of football and cut straight to saving the universe. It's not the athlete who's going to change police brutality, he told me. It's not the athlete who's going to change all this stuff. But pro athletes are invited to the table, he said. They can try to speak to and for those who aren't in the room. This article was shortened to fit the broadcast. And now, from the September 7th, 2018, digital edition of the New Yorker magazine, the sporting scene section, Kaepernick, Trump, and the NFL in the eyes of a player who protested during the national anthem 50 years ago by Ben McGrath. On Tuesday, amid news that the teamless quarterback Colin Kaepernick would be the new face of Nike's 30th anniversary Just Do It campaign, David Megacy, a retired NFL activist, mused about Marxist dialectics and the echoes of 1968. "This is not a new story, but it keeps coming around," he said. "The co-option versus the message, that's always been going on. Advertisers, they figure it out. It's how the effing system works, and blatantly at that." Megacy is a Kaepernick supporter, to be clear, and not a Marxist necessarily, he said, while noting the coincidence that we were talking the day after Labor Day. He'd been reading an interview with Cornel West in which the public intellectual discussed his expulsion from school as a third grader for refusing to salute the flag. "My great uncle had been lynched when he'd come out of the army, and his killers had wrapped a flag around his body. So when my teacher told me to salute the same flag, I said no," said Cornel West. "He nails it on many levels," Megacy said of West. "And LeBron and Serena, I saw this morning they're supporting Colin. Of course, I would love to see some of the white players really say something to make a statement as well. If you had Aaron Rodgers or Tom Brady lay it out there, 'Colin, you got effed. You're a great player. It's a effing travesty. And Trump, you're a effing a-hole.' But we're all sleepwalking." Megacy, who played 7 years as a linebacker for the St. Louis Cardinals, was in a sense the original Kaepernick, a dissident who was accused of disrespecting the national anthem in a sport with a culture that has long celebrated authoritarian deference. Thinking back to 50 years ago, he recalled that Super Bowl II, in January of 1968, had featured the debut of the military flyover tradition at the conclusion of the Star-Spangled Banner, an innovation of the NFL commissioner at the time, Pete Rozelle. "Pete jumped into bed with the Nixon sensibility," Megacy said. Then October brought the Summer Olympics in Mexico City, where the African-American sprinters Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised gloved fist in a Black Power salute on the medal podium, leading to their expulsion from the Olympic Village. "Orders came down from Rozelle," Megacy recalled. "When the anthem played before NFL games, you had to line up along the sideline, holding your helmet in your left arm against your armpit and your right hand on your heart while turning toward the flag." Megacy refused. "I stood there, but I was bowing my head, not on my knee, and had my helmet hanging by my side," he said. He also shuffled his feet, a nervous rebel, not a picture of poised defiance worthy of a sneaker campaign. "Clearly, I was the one person doing it," he said, adding that his teammates were squeaky clean. "For me, it was two things," Megacy continued. "Number one, being told how to salute the flag. Don't tell me what to do. And number two was my anti-war sentiment. I just thought, this is BS. The indignity of realizing the NFL is supporting the war by being super patriotic. I'm protesting that they're trying to support the Vietnam War with Nixon and Agnew and all the boys." A local columnist objected, as did some Cardinal fans, on a radio call-in show. Megacy was summoned to a midnight meeting at the home of his defensive coach, Chuck Drulis. "He basically said, 'You've got to stop what you're doing or you're going to get cut,'" Megacy went on. "I was furious about it. I said, 'What does this have to do with football?' I got my friend Irving Louis Horowitz, who was a sociologist at Washington University in St. Louis, and he counseled me in writing a letter to Cardinal management saying, essentially, 'Don't F with us, or we're going to F with you.'" Megacy's private opposition to the war grew more formal, and he started hosting meetings for other citizen activists at his house and paying for buses to deliver them to marches in Washington, D.C. and New York City. "I was into it, but I wasn't public about it," he said. Nonetheless, he started converting some of his previously apolitical teammates, and in 1969, he got more than 30 of them to sign a letter to their local congressman calling for a withdrawal of American troops. Then, suddenly a couple of weeks later, I'm benched, he said. He retired after the 1969 season at age 28 and wrote a kind of expose out of their league that is sometimes likened to Jim Bouton's Ball 4 for its revelations about, among other things, rampant trainer-approved drug use among his fellow professional athletes. Appearing on the Dick Cavett Show to promote the book alongside a chain-smoking defensive end, Janis Joplin, Magacy said that football, which bent my head around in some strange ways, amounted to Middle America's theater, Nixon's theater, the opiate of the silent majority. Ahead of his time by a generation or two, he also told Cavett that he thought college football players represented, quote, one of the most exploited minorities in the country because their compensation amounted to about 25 cents an hour. He later worked as an executive in the NFL Players Association, where he told me his work primarily consisted of telling young football players, wake up, boys. Mark Leibovich's new book, The Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times, which posits in the introduction that the country's dominant form of entertainment in the age of President Trump, quote, no longer felt safely bubbled off from the messiness and politics of the larger American reality show, end quote, as though this were a phenomenon without precedent. Leibovich, a national correspondent for the Times magazine and a lifelong Patriots fanatic, writes that for years he'd, quote, resisted sports as anything but a walled-off object of my mental energy, toys to play with on the side of all the serious, end quote. Only to find that once he'd started immersing himself in the NFL as a reporter, it no longer seemed like a respite from his day job. Trumpism was inescapable. An important difference between 50 years ago and now, Magacy stressed, was that Nixon was using football to sell an actual war, and it wasn't much of a stretch for Roselle, the commissioner, to imagine that his league's players might project an obedient, clean-cut image that reflected their own cultural backgrounds. Magacy, as he told Cavett, grew up in a cow town, the son of a farmer. The team's rosters at the time were more than 70% white. Trump, on the other hand, is selling only nostalgia for the days of guilt-free bell ringers, say, to a base that has little in common with the majority of the players on the field, 70% of whom now are African American. With only a few exceptions, it seems he doesn't want you to root for the men on the field, nor does he want you to root for Goodell, a weak guy, he said, and he doesn't want you to root for the owners either, who represent a club that wouldn't have him as a member. Big Game, in fact, suggests an alternative origin story to the Trump presidency. Maybe it wasn't set in motion by Barack Obama's mockery at the White House Correspondents Association dinner in 2011, but rather by Trump's failure a few years later to acquire the Buffalo Bills, 2 decades after having been coldly rebuffed by Roselle. In the end, a seat at the NFL membership table is so exclusive that even the White House itself has become a consolation prize, Leibovich writes. In celebrating the NFL's declining TV viewership, way down, Trump tweeted recently, the president may not be using football for any purpose other than to prove himself the only remaining ratings giant in American life. In any event, the anthem in Philly, delayed nearly an hour by stormy weather and sung a cappella by Boys to Men, seems not to have aroused the ire of Trump or his Nike-burning supporters. The safety, Malcolm Jenkins, a co-founder of the Players Coalition, placed his hands behind his back instead of raising a fist in the air as he had done in the past. The defensive end, Michael Bennett, paced the sideline and finally sat on the bench to tie his shoes. In 1968, it might have passed for disrespect. Kaepernick's Nike ad, long since viewed and digested on the internet by anyone inclined to strong opinions on the subject, aired during the third quarter. The game went on. And now, from the June 10th, 2016 edition of the New Yorker Online, from the news desk, Muhammad Ali and His Audience, by Allison Hobbs. Muhammad Ali's funeral is today in Louisville, Kentucky, and he will be laid to rest as the city's favorite son. Much has changed since Ali, born Cassius Clay in the segregated South, the grandson of a slave, learned to box at the age of 12. After he won the Olympic gold medal in 1960, Ali returned home to Jim Crow Louisville and found he was still barred from white-only restaurants and was still called boy on the street. The course of his life offers evidence of the many turning points in African-American and American history from the mid-20th century to the present. Ali started out as an underdog, which seems surprising in retrospect. In February 1964, Sonny Liston was favored, with 7-1 odds to win their first fight. But Ali predicted that he would beat Liston in 6 rounds, and he did. The next day, he made the stunning announcement that he was a member of the Nation of Islam. He rid himself of his, quote, slave name and the Christian religion, and he insisted on being called Muhammad Ali. Ali was unapologetically black, and he was outspoken about the civil rights struggles of the 1960s. "I am America," he once said. "I am the part you won't recognize, but get used to me. Black, confident, cocky, my name, not yours, my religion, not yours, my goals, my own, get used to me." Some did, and some did not. It was impossible to measure just how much Ali meant to many African Americans across the country. In a remembrance of Ali published this week, the novelist Walter Mosley recalled being a child and seeing a black man standing in a crossroad declaring, "I am the greatest," with his fist held high above his head. The man startled Mosley, but his words made an impression. "Even then I heard the pride and hurt, the dashed ambition and the shard of hope that cut through him," Mosley wrote. Cassius Clay's declaration had become his own. The Black Pride movement was on, and one of its pillars were these 4 words. But not everyone delighted in spirited calls for black power. Many African Americans disagreed with the separatist views of black nationalism. Newspapers and publications, including The Times, continued to print Cassius Clay instead of Muhammad Ali. In 1967, Ali refused to go to Vietnam, famously announcing to the press, "I ain't got no trouble with them Viet Cong. It ain't right. They never called me the N-word." Jackie Robinson, for one, disagreed with Ali's stance. Boxing fans booed Ali, called him a traitor. But as Henry Louis Gates Jr. recently noted, when Martin Luther King Jr. expressed his own anti-war position in 1967, he borrowed heavily from the boxer. Quote, "Like Muhammad Ali puts it, we are all, black and brown and poor, victims of the same system of oppression," end quote. Black and white anti-war activists joined hands, following Ali's example of commitment and conviction. For challenging the United States government, he was stripped of his title. The Supreme Court restored his boxing license only in 1974, after Ali lost several of his prime boxing years. Losing his best years, never knowing just how great the greatest could have been, resonated deeply with African American struggles and with those who had their hopes dashed because they could never find out how far they might have gone. One night in November 1989, my father was at a restaurant in Greenwich, Connecticut, having dinner with some former colleagues from his days as a marketing executive at IBM. As he came out of the bathroom, he caught a glimpse of Ali, his hero, walking toward him. He could hardly believe his eyes. He was an avid boxing fan, and he admired everything about Ali. His confidence, his style, his poetics, his good looks. My father had served as a reserve officer in the Army in the years before the Vietnam War escalated, but he still deeply respected Ali's courage and the sacrifices he'd made. Muhammad? He asked, incredulous. Ali didn't say a word. Instead, he threw playful jabs, hooks, and punches at my father. He agreed to meet the rest of my father's dinner companions, and even offered to cover his head with his coat so he would not be recognized when he approached. My father interrupted the dinner. Ali revealed himself, and members of the group sat in stunned silence. They had come expecting a quiet meal, and now they were standing in the presence of an American icon. Ali then obliged the crowd with a series of magic tricks performed with a dinner napkin. Ali loved people and loved to entertain, even at a reunion of former IBM employees at a restaurant in Greenwich. There won't be another Muhammad Ali. Ali gave us a glimpse of our better selves. He could take blood-curdling punch, get knocked down, get up, and keep fighting. But he also showed us how difficult the fight is. Even when he was 65, he joked about shaking up the world and returning to the ring, seeking the glory of the comeback. African Americans remain in the ring because there is work yet to be done. In life, Ali fought outside of the ring too. He didn't always win. His body failed him, but he shaped American history. He was a pretty man who was far more than a boxer, who had uncommon courage and conviction, a man who announced that he was the greatest long before he ever knew he was. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. As always, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.